It's Tuesday, June 18, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We've been tracing the fact that one of the most significant events during our lifetimes is this vast moral change on the issue of human sexuality in general and homosexuality in particular. The velocity of the cultural and moral change taking place around us is unprecedented in human history, and that's very easy to document. What also must be documented is the fact that one of the major drivers of that cultural and moral change are the mainstream media outlets all around us, and the fact that they are defining the issues that are considered by most Americans on a 24/7 basis. Now comes a report from the Pew Research Organization indicating that, as the journal Broadcast and Cable reports, of nearly 500 news stories on same-sex marriage examined in this recent study, those focused on support outnumbered those focused on opposition by about 5-1, whether those were opinion pieces or news stories. As John Egerton of Broadcasting and Cable reports, all told, of stories that aired March 18 through May the 12th of this year, while the U.S. Supreme Court was debating the issue of same-sex marriage, 47% of stories focused on support, while 9% largely focused on opposition, and 44% were fairly even or provided no views at all. Amy Mitchell, acting director for the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, said, and I quote, "This study shows how same-sex marriage supporters have had a clear message and succeeded in getting that message across all sectors of mainstream media." She went on to say, "In addition, many of the events during the period studied, such as announcements by politicians and state legislation, reflect movement toward same-sex marriage," end quote. There is some validity in her point here. And that is that not only were the reports 5-1 outnumbered in terms of support for same-sex marriage, but also the events themselves were driving much of that media coverage. But not all of it. Perhaps the most revealing section of this study indicates that the stories were pro-gay marriage by a ratio of 5-1, whether they were opinion pieces or news stories. It's that latter category that's far more problematic. Similarly, Chris Saliza, writing in the Washington Post, reports, "We've written repeatedly that the political fight over gay marriage is all but over due to increased acceptance across a broad section of society of same-sex couples' right to marry." He then goes on to say, "This new study by the Pew Research Center raises an important question about that perceived momentum. Is it being created, at least in part, by positive news media coverage of the possibility of legalization?" To that very good question, we simply have to respond, obviously so. Saliza then goes on to quote this report from Pew, "In a period marked by Supreme Court deliberations on the subject, the news media coverage provided a strong sense of momentum towards legalizing same-sex marriage. Stories with more statements supporting same-sex marriage outweighed those with more statements opposing it by that margin of roughly 5-1. Saliza reports in greater detail that 47% of news stories on same-sex marriage, when the Supreme Court was hearing oral arguments on the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8, focused on support for the measure. Just 9% focused on opposition, and that 44% was mixed, at least mixed as it's classified here, in its focus. Saliza then summarizes, "That coverage is far more tilted in favor of legalization than Pew's polling of the electorate as a whole. 51% of voters say they believe gay marriage should be legal, while 42% believe it should be illegal." In other words, what Chris Saliza is documenting here is the fact that the mainstream media are far more pro-gay marriage than the American people. Why is this so? Chris Saliza theorizes, quote, "The forces in support of same-sex marriage are simply better organized, message-wise, than the forces against it," end quote. He credits the Pew Research Center with that idea, but as he explains it, it really turns out to be something different than what Pew is arguing. He's arguing here that the proponents of same-sex marriage are, he says, better organized message-wise. It turns out that the organization of the message really isn't the issue. He quotes the Pew study as saying, "The central argument among proponents of same-sex marriage was one of civil rights. Arguments against were more varied, but most often voiced the idea that same-sex marriage would harm society and the institution of traditional marriage," end quote. It isn't the organization of the message that turns out here to be the problem. It's the message. In other words, in postmodern America, Americans are far more likely to be driven by an argument for civil rights than an argument against social change. It's a very perceptive point, and yet Chris Saliza kind of turns it around as an organizational problem or a messaging problem. But the problem is organizational if there would be a better way to organize the same message. There probably isn't. It's the message itself that is the problem. The messaging of why the defenders of marriage would oppose same-sex marriage is just on weaker public ground in an increasingly secularized and postmodern America. In the American culture we now face, we need to face the facts that our neighbors are more easily driven by virtually any kind of civil rights argument, even if it's one that is embedded within a theme of moral revolution. Saliza also writes, quote, "There is a bit of chicken and egg going on here. Lots and lots of polling done over the last few months suggests that public opinion is in fact moving across virtually every demographic measure in favor of legalization of same-sex marriage." So, he argues, while the Pew study does show real and significant opposition to allowing gay people to marry, the coverage focuses on what is news, which is movement towards legalization, end quote. That is a massive journalistic rationalization. In other words, he's arguing that any argument for change has more news value than an argument against it. But just consider what that would mean. If journalistic ethics is tilted in that direction, then it can work as easily against the proponents of same-sex marriage as it will work for them. Because if indeed the proponents of change should be given privilege in any journalistic context, then the change away from same-sex marriage would be just as much change as the revolution that will bring it about. Furthermore, that rationalization masks the fact that, as the Pew study demonstrates conclusively, those who are driving the mainstream media are, to a great extent, driving the energy for the legalization of same-sex marriage. It's hardly fair then to turn around and suggest that it's a chicken and egg situation, when in this case it's the chicken that's clearly producing the egg. The old political adage reminds us that those who live by the polls will die by the polls. That must be resounding right now in the Obama administration's White House, after news came out yesterday that two major polls indicated that the American people are growing increasingly dissatisfied with two things. The first is the direction of the country, and the second is the leadership of President Obama and his administration. The first is out from Time magazine yesterday, indicating that 58% of Americans surveyed said that the United States, as a national picture, is going in the wrong direction. What makes that particularly interesting is that it's a significant reversal from where Americans were just a matter of a few months ago. What does that tell us? Well, it doesn't tell us necessarily a great deal about the culture. It tells us a great deal about the political moment. Americans, who are often asked this kind of question by pollsters, tend to indicate on the basis of their own personal mood, but even more than that, the perception of their neighbors and coworkers and friends' moods. How do people think the country is doing? But of course, this is really a question about leadership. It's as much right now subverted by the things going on in the culture, controversies over the national surveillance state, other things having to do with the IRS and all the rest. It may have had nothing to do with anything that happened in a single individual answering this survey, but it does tell you about national perception. The second poll came out, and this one's even more interesting. CNN reports that a poll that they did with ORC indicates that the Obama administration is losing key political support amongst its key political supporters. In other words, younger Americans. As CNN Politics reports, President Barack Obama's national approval rating dropped 8 percentage points over just the last month. It has dropped to 45%, which is President Obama's lowest rating in more than 18 months. But what's most interesting is that the overall decline in his approval rating was partially fueled by a plunge in support from younger Americans, the huge base of President Obama's support. Why would younger Americans all of a sudden abandon President Obama? Well, it turns out that one of their major concerns, according to the CNN poll, is personal privacy. And they now see President Obama's defense of the PRISM program undertaken by the National Security Administration as a threat to their personal privacy. Many younger Americans now see President Obama as having gone over to the dark side when it comes to the national surveillance state, and his defense of the collection and use of this kind of data is very alarming to younger Americans. But there we see the interesting contradiction, don't we? Because these younger Americans are actually posting all kinds of things about themselves in social media. They seem to have no problem whatsoever detailing exactly what they ate, drank, and what they did with whom in terms of social media, but they don't want Big Brother watching. This is a very interesting cultural observation. Here we have a generation of younger Americans. Younger Americans who read them onto Barack Obama as a candidate and now are discovering that, of all things, politicians turn out to disappoint them. That's true of every politician, of course. In this case, you have younger Americans who are discovering that President Obama, after all, is President of the United States, meaning that he will make decisions that they will not support and they will not like. This one seems to be particularly perplexing, however. A generation of younger Americans who tell their friends just about everything want to make sure that their big brother knows very little. There are big issues, of course, here of concern to all Americans with the collection of this surveillance data. But when you look at it, you realize that it reveals some major fault lines in our culture. Fault lines about the trust of government. And these younger Americans, who just a few months ago said that they increasingly trusted government, are beginning to wonder about the government in which they invested that trust. The Christian worldview reminds us that no government, no regime is to be fully trusted. Why? Because in a fallen world, we recognize that every single government is made up of very fallible, that is to say, sinful human beings. And especially when they are attracted together to power, the kind of power that government has, that government controls, that government accumulates, and that government protects. That's when you recognize that even a government held to the standards of the United States Constitution can't on its own be trusted. The founders of the American Republic didn't ask citizens to trust the government. They demanded that the government trust the citizens. And it turns out that on the issue of same-sex marriage, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, of all things, turns out to be ground zero for what could be a precedent-setting landmark case. As Jason Riley of the Courier-Journal in Louisville reports, prosecutors say Geneva Case heard her spouse admit to killing a man 2 years ago and saw her clean blood out of the man's van and abandon it in southern Indiana. Now they argue Case must testify about those facts, even though Kentucky law exempts spouses from being compelled to testify against each other. The reason, they say, is that Case and the defendant, Bobby Joe Clary, entered into a same-sex civil union in Vermont in 2004, and Kentucky doesn't recognize same-sex civil unions or marriages. The prosecutor in the case said that ceremony is not a marriage that is valid and recognized under Kentucky law. Geneva Case and the defendant cannot prove the existence of a marriage under Kentucky law. The Courier-Journal then goes on to report that attorneys for Clary say they are legally married, and denying them the same marital rights others have would be a violation of the Constitution. Now let's step back for a moment and recognize that we're awaiting, probably within a week, a decision by the United States Supreme Court on a legal challenge to the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act. Passed back in 1996, signed into law by President Bill Clinton, the Defense of Marriage Act defined marriage for the federal government as the union exclusively of a man and a woman. And it also stated emphatically that no state could be required to recognize a same-sex union legally valid elsewhere. That becomes a key issue now, but the court in Kentucky says it's not going to wait for the United States Supreme Court to decide before the judge in this case makes the decision as to whether Geneva Case has to testify against the individual defendant in this case in a murder trial who she argues is her spouse. As Jason Riley reports, the case has become the first legal test in the state over forcing same-sex partners to testify against each other, raising the broader issue of whether the state recognizes marriages or civil unions that are legal elsewhere. The case could have ramifications for issues such as divorces and the division of property after death. Riley's report in the Courier-Journal provides some very important background information. He writes, for example, in 2001, according to the Associated Press, a Maryland judge ruled that a woman who married her lesbian partner in Washington, D.C., could invoke her right not to testify against her in a domestic assault case. The judge ruled that Maryland generally recognizes a marriage as valid as long as it was valid in the jurisdiction in which it took place. Maryland's law legalizing same-sex marriage took effect in January. But we need to recognize that the state of Kentucky is among those states that passed a constitutional amendment preventing the recognition of same-sex marriage. It's going to be very interesting to see exactly how this case develops. But no one really expected the Commonwealth of Kentucky to be ground zero for this kind of case in the first place. Another indication of the fact that if DOMA is struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, a story like this could be coming to a state very near you. Demographic data continue to pour in. Sam Roberts' reporting for the New York Times last week indicates that deaths exceeded births among non-Hispanic white Americans for the first time in at least a century. That information is coming from new census data, a benchmark that heralds profound demographic change, writes Roberts, and he's exactly right. The disparity in this case was actually quite small, at least statistically speaking. 12,000 more white Americans died than were born. But just consider the trajectory of that kind of development and consider what this means. White Americans are having smaller families and are receding as a total component of the American population. Not only is America headed into a situation in which in just a few decades we will be a non-majority nation, that is, no racial or ethnic group will hold a majority of American citizens, but we're also headed into a situation in which America is going to be radically transformed by immigration patterns, demographic developments such as these, and variable birth rates among those who live within this nation. This means that for American Christians, the mission field is going to change quickly. It means for our churches that the communities around them will also change. And if we do not adapt to these changes, we will not be a missional people, a Great Commission people, in the 21st century. Not in this country, much less in any other country. A very revealing article appeared in the Financial Times last week. Anna Feifeld, reporting on abortion laws in the United States, suggests that American legislators are now opening new fronts in the battle to outlaw abortion. At the center of this is the new law now being considered by the United States House of Representatives that would outlaw abortion after the baby is able to experience documented pain. Feifeld then goes to Mississippi, a state like some others in the United States that has only one functioning abortion clinic, and she argues that the pro-life movement, having failed at least to this point to overturn Roe v. Wade in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court, is trying to make abortion very rare by making abortion clinics very rare. And of course, she's absolutely right. And the pro-life movement would offer no apologies, but would suggest publicly that that is exactly what the movement is trying to do. She takes us to Dr. Willie Parker, a Chicago abortionist who flies into Mississippi and Alabama to perform abortions regularly. Dr. Parker offered a very revealing comment in this article in the Financial Times. He said, quote, "There are moral and religious aspects to abortion, but they are for people to determine individually and privately. The fact that this has been made a public and political issue is a function of the marginalization of women," end quote. A very revealing statement. In other words, so far as this abortionist is concerned, there is only one human being that's even of concern here. The baby simply isn't mentioned, because the baby doesn't appear here. The baby is invisible. The baby doesn't count. That's why the pro-abortion movement is losing so much ground. In an age in which most children have seen their siblings as ultrasound images, in an age in which a mother can look within her own womb by the ultrasound technology, in an age in which we now know so much more than previous generations knew, and we cannot deny that knowledge, it's becoming increasingly difficult to argue that the woman is the only morally significant agent in this situation. Dr. Willie Parker says that there are moral and religious aspects to abortion, but they're just individual and private matters. This tells you a great deal about the logic of the abortion movement in the United States. It also tells us why that movement is in moral retreat, a retreat we can hope that will move all the way to pushing back the culture of death in favor of the culture of life. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.